She was in tears, sobbing as if her heart would break. Without thinking, I went to her, put my arms around her, and pulled her head against my shoulder. "It's all right," I said, even though it wasn't. But something inside me had undergone a sudden shift, as if my interior furniture had been rearranged unexpectedly, and I knew, with a strange new calmness, that we would sort things out later. "Wait here until I come back," I said. "Father's expecting me downstairs, and I mustn't keep him waiting." Which was true, as far as it went. As I walked back into the drawing room, Sergeant Graves was still standing quite close to Feely, a look of disappointment on his face. "I put it in this," I explained, handing Inspector Hewitt a square cardboard box, "so that there would be the least number of points in contact with the glass surface." I did not explain that, because it was precisely the right size, I had pinched the box from Feely's bedroom, nor did I mention that I had flushed a pound of Yardley's lavender bath salts down the toilet for want of a better place to put it on short notice. The inspector lifted the top flap gingerly and glanced inside. "You'll find a ring of faint smudges on the glass," I said. "Most likely whatever's left of the fingerprint." "Thank you, Flavia," he said in a flat voice, handing the box to Sergeant Graves. "And perhaps a few of mine," I added. "Take this straight away to Sergeant Woolmer in Hindley," the inspector said, ignoring my small joke. "Come back for me later." "Yes, sir," Sergeant Graves said. "Hindley it is." "Hold on a minute," I said. "There's more." I carefully pulled one of Feely's embroidered handkerchiefs from my pocket. "This," I said, "might well be a copy of the silver lobster pick that killed Brookie Harewood. Or perhaps it's the original. It's got the Deleuze monogram on it. One of the Bull children was digging with it in the gully. If there are any fingerprints on it besides his and mine, you'll quite likely find that they match the ones on the crystal ball." I looked round the room to watch the reactions on everyone's faces as I handed the thing over to Inspector Hewitt. "As Mrs. Mallet once said, you could have heard a pin droop."
"Good Lord," Father said, stepping forward and reaching for the thing, even as the inspector was still unwrapping it.
I had almost blurted out that the rest of the family silver was on its way to Sotheby's, but something made me hold my tongue. What a bitter blow to Father it would have been had I let that slip out.
"Please, Colonel, don't touch it," the inspector said. "I'm afraid this must now be treated as evidence."
Father stood staring at the silver lobster pick as if he were a snake that had come unexpectedly face to face with a mongoose. Daffy sat bolt upright on the divan, glaring at me with what I took to be hatred in her eyes, as if she held me responsible for all of Father's misfortunes. Feely's hand was at her mouth. All of these details were frozen on the instant, as if a photographer's flash had gone off and preserved forever a thin and uncomfortable slice of time. The silence in the room was audible.
"Killed Brookie Harewood?" Inspector Hewitt said at last, turning to me. "This lobster pick? Please explain what you mean by that."
"It was in his nose," I said, "when I found his body hanging from the Poseidon fountain. Surely you saw it?" Now it was the inspector's turn to stare in disbelief at the object in his hand.
"You're quite sure?" he asked.
"Positive," I said, a little peeved that he should doubt me. I could see that the inspector was choosing his words carefully before he spoke.
"We found no lobster pick at the scene of the crime, and none has turned up subsequently."
"No lobster pick at the scene of the crime? What a ludicrous statement! It was like denying the sun in the sky. The thing had been there plain as day, stuck up Brookie's nostril like a dart in a corkboard. If the pick had fallen out through force of gravity, for instance, the police would have found it in the fountain. The fact that they hadn't could mean only one thing. That someone had removed it. And that someone, most likely, was Brookie's killer.
Between the time Porcelain and I had walked away from the fountain and the time that the police arrived, no more than, say, 20 minutes, the killer had crept back, scaled the fountain, and removed the weapon from Brookie's nose. But why? The inspector was still staring at me intently. I could see his cogs turning. "Surely you don't think I killed Brookie Harewood?" I gasped.
"As a matter of fact, I don't," Inspector Hewitt said.
"But something tells me that you know who did." I didn't move a muscle, but inwardly I positively preened. "Fancy that," I thought. "Recognition at last." I could have hugged the man, but I didn't. He'd have been mortified, and so, but only later, of course, would I. "I have my suspicions," I said, fighting to keep my voice from sliding into an upper register.
"Ah," the inspector said, "then you must share them with us sometime.
Well, thank you all. It has been most illuminating." He summoned Sergeant Graves with his eyebrows and went to the door.
"Oh, and Colonel," he said, turning back, "you will keep Flavia at home?"
Father did not reply, and for that I decided on the spot his name would be inscribed forever in my private book of saints and martyrs. And then, with a rustle of officialdom, the police were gone.
"Do you think he likes me?" Feely asked, making a beeline for the looking-glass on the chimney-piece.
"I should say so," Daffy replied.
"He was all green eyes like the monster cuttlefish in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea."
With no more than a look of perplexity, Father left the room. Within minutes, I knew, he would be submerged in his stamp collection, alone with whatever squids and cuttlefish inhabited the depths of his mind. At that moment, I remembered Porcelain. It didn't come easily to me to knock at the door of my own laboratory, but knock I did. No point in startling Porcelain and ending up with my throat slit from ear to ear. But when I stepped inside, the laboratory was empty, and I felt my anger rising. Blast her! Hadn't I told her to stay where she was until I returned? But when I opened my bedroom door, there she was, sitting cross-legged on my bed like a malnourished Buddha, reading my notebook. It was too much. "What do you think you're doing?" I shouted, running across the room and snatching the book from her hand.
"Reading about myself," she said. I'll admit it, I saw red.
No, that's not quite true. I first saw white. A silent, brilliant white that erased everything, like the A-bombs that had been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Only after this deadly burst of flower petals had begun to cool and fade, passing first from yellow through orange, did it at last simmer down to red. I had been angry before, but this was like something ripped from the pages of the Book of Revelation. Could it be some secret fault in the Deluce makeup that was manifesting itself in me for the first time? Until now, my fury had always been like those jolly Caribbean carnivals we had seen in the cinema travelogues, a noisy explosion of colour and heat that wilted steadily as the day went on. But now it had suddenly become an icy coldness, a frigid wasteland in which I stood unapproachable. And it was in that instant, I think, that I began to understand my father. This much was clear. I needed to get away, to be alone, until the tidal wave had passed.
"Excuse me," I said abruptly, surprising even myself, and walked out of the room.
I sat for a while on the stairs, neither up nor down. It was true that Porcelain had violated my privacy, but my response had frightened me. In fact, I was still shaking a little. I riffled idly through the pages of my notebook, not really focusing upon its written entries. What had Porcelain been reading when I interrupted her? She had been reading about herself, or so she claimed. I could hardly remember what I had written. I quickly found the spot. Porcelain. Can't possibly be her grandmother's attacker, since she was in London at the time. Or was she? I have only her word for it, but why did she feel compelled to wash out her clothing? The answer to that remained a puzzle, but surely, if Porcelain had come back to do me in, she'd have done so by now. As I closed the book, I remembered that at the time my last notes were made, I had not yet met the Pettibones. I had promised the Queen Bee that I would bring her some papers from Buckshaw relating to Nicodemus Flitch and the Hobblers. The fact that I had fabricated these juicy documents on the spur of the moment was really of no importance. With a library like Buckshaw's, there might very well be documents lurking that would satisfy the woman's obvious greed. If the library was unoccupied, I could begin my search at once. I was feeling better already. I listened with my ear glued to the door. If Daffy was inside reading, as she usually was, I could swallow a teaspoon of pride and ask her opinion, perhaps under cover of an insult which almost always resulted in her taking the bait. If that didn't work, there was always the solemn truce. Under these rules, I would, immediately upon entering the room, drop to one knee on the carpet and declare, "Pax verbiscum," and if Daffy replied, "Eight cum spiritu tuo," the ceasefire went into effect for a period of 5 minutes by the mantel clock, during which time neither of us was allowed to offer any incivility to the other. If, on the other hand, she flung an inkwell, then the peace pipe was declined and the whole thing was off. But there was no sound from the other side of the panel. I opened the door and peeked round it. The library was empty. I stepped inside and closed the door behind me. For safety's sake, I turned the key in the lock and, although it probably hadn't been operated in the past 100 years, the bolt slid home in perfect silence. Good old dogger, I thought. He had a way of seeing that essentials were taken care of. If anyone questioned me, I would claim that I was feeling somewhat peaked and had hoped to have a nap without being disturbed. I turned and had a good look round the library. It was simply ages since I'd been alone in this room. The bookshelves towered towards the ceiling in strata, as if they had been formed geologically in stacks by the upwards shifting of the earth. Near the floor and closest to hand were the books that belonged to the present generation of Deluces. Above these, and just out of reach, were those that had been hoarded by the house's Victorian inhabitants, above which, piled to the ceiling, was the rubbish left behind by the Georgians, hundreds and hundreds of leather and calf-bound volumes with thin, worm-eaten pages, and type so small it made your eyes go buggy. I'd had a squint once before at some of these relics, but had found them devoted mainly to the lives and sermons of a bunch of dry old sticks who had lived and died while Mozart was still crawling around in diapers. If ever there was a graveyard of religious biography, this was it. I'd worked methodically, I thought, one wall at a time, top of the north wall first, then top of the east wall, and so forth. Books about dissenting clergymen were not exactly kept at one's fingertips at Buckshaw. Besides, I wasn't sure exactly what I was searching for, but I knew that I would likely find it nearer the ceiling. I dragged the rolling library ladder into position and began my climb. Up, 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 my footing more precarious with every step. Libraries of this design, I thought, ought to be equipped with oxygen bottles above a certain height in case of altitude sickness. Which made me think of Harriet, and a sudden sadness came over me. Harriet had scaled these very same bookcases once upon a time. In fact, it was stumbling upon one of her chemistry texts in this very room that had changed my life. "Get on with it, Flave," said a strict-sounding voice inside me. "Harriet is dead, and you've got work to do." Up I went, my head still cocked at an uncomfortable angle from reading titles on book spines at the lower levels. Fortunately, at this higher altitude, the older volumes had sensible, no-nonsense, horizontal titles stamped deeply into their spines in gold-leaf letters, making them three-dimensional and relatively easy to read in the perpetual twilight near the ceiling. The Life of Simeon Hoxie, Notes on the Septuagint, Prayer and Penance, Pew's thoughts upon godliness, astronomical principles of religion natural and revealed, the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, Polycarp of Smyrna, and so forth. Just above these was hydraulics and hydrostatics, a relic, no doubt, of Lucius Leaking de Luce. I pulled the book from the shelf and opened it. Sure enough, there was Lucius's bookplate, the de Luce family crest, with his name written beneath it in a surprisingly childish hand. Had he owned the book when he was a boy? The title page was almost completely covered with dense, inky calculations, sums, angles, algebraic equations, all of them more hurried than neat, crabbed, cramped, and rushing across the page. The entire book was somewhat rippled, as if it had once been wet. A folded paper had been inserted between the pages which, when I opened it out flat, proved to be a hand-drawn map, but a map unlike any I had ever seen before. Scattered upon the page were circles of various sizes, each joined to the others by lines, some of which radiated directly to their targets, while others followed more rectangular and roundabout paths. Some of the lines were thick, some thin. Some were single, others double, and a few were shaded in various schemes of cross-hatching. At first I thought it was a railway map, so dense were the tracks. Perhaps an ambitious expansion scheme for the nearby Buckshaw Halt, where trains had once stopped to put down guests and unload goods for the great house. Only when I recognised the shape at the bottom of the map as the ornamental lake and the unmistakable outline of Buckshaw itself, did I realise that the document was, in fact, not a map at all, but a diagram. Lucius Leaking de Luce's plan for his subterranean hydraulic operations. Interesting, I thought, but only vaguely. I shoved the paper into my pocket for future reference and resumed my search for books that might contain some mention of the Hobblers. Sermons for Sailors, God's Plan for the Indies, Remains of Alexander Knox, Esquire. And suddenly, there it was. English Dissenters. I must say, it was an eye-opener. I suppose I had been expecting a dry-as-dust account of hellfire parsons and dozing parishioners. But what I had stumbled upon was a treasure trove of jealousy, backbiting, vanity, abductions, harrowing midnight escapes, hangings, mutilations, betrayal, and sorcery. Wherever there had been savage bloodshed in 17th and 18th century English history, there was sure to have been a dissenter at the heart of it. I made a note to take some of these volumes up to my bedroom for a bit of horrific bedtime reading. They would certainly be more lively than Wind in the Willows, which had been languishing on my night table since Aunt Felicity had sent it to me for Christmas, pretending to believe it was a history of corporal punishment. With English Dissenters in hand, I climbed down the ladder, dropped into the upholstered wing-back chair that Daffy usually occupied, and began flipping through its pages in search of the Hobblers. Because there was no index, I was forced to go slowly, watching for the word Hobblers, trying not to become too distracted by the violence of the religious text. Only towards the end of the book did I find what I was looking for. But then, suddenly, there it was, at the bottom of a page, in a footnote marked by a squashed spider asterisk, set in quaint, old-fashioned type. "The Mischief of Infant Baptism," it said, "is an innovation of the primitive practice of the Church, one of the corruptions of the second or third century. It is, moreover, often made the occasion of sin, or is turned into a farce as, for example, in that custom of the sect, known as the Hobblers, whose dipping of a child, held by the heel into running water, must be understood as no more than a bizarre, not to say barbaric, survival of the Greek myth of Achilles." It took several moments for the words to sink in. Mrs. Mullet had been right! Chapter 27. Up the east staircase I flew. English dissenters clutched in my hand. I couldn't contain myself. "Listen to this," I said, bursting into my bedroom. Porcelain was sitting exactly as I had left her, staring at me as if I were a madwoman. I read aloud to her the footnote on infant baptism, the words fairly tumbling from my mouth.
"So what?" she said, unimpressed.
"Mrs. Ball," I blurted out. "She lied. Her baby drowned. It had nothing to do with Fenella."
"I don't know what you're talking about," Porcelain said.
"Of course she didn't. I hadn't told her about the encounter with the enraged Mrs. Ball in the gully." I could still hear those frightening, hateful words in my mind.
"Gypsy! Gypsy! Clear off!" she had screamed at Fenella. "'Twas you as stole my baby! Tom, get out here! That gypsy's at the gate!"
Thinking to spare Porcelain's feelings, I skated quickly over the story of the bull baby's disappearance and of the furious outburst its mother had directed at Fenella in the gully. Mrs. Mallet's friend had told her the hobblers dipped their babies by the heel, like Achilles in the River Styx. She didn't quite put it that way, but that's what she meant.
"So you see," I finished triumphantly, "Fenella had nothing to do with it."
"Of course she didn't," Porcelain scoffed.
"She's a harmless old woman, not a kidnapper. Don't tell me you believe those old wives' tales about gypsy stealing babies."
"Of course I don't," I said, but I was not being truthful.
In my heart of hearts I had, until that very minute, believed what every child in England had been made to believe. Porcelain was becoming huffy again, and I didn't want to risk another outburst, either from her, or worse, from me.
"She's that redhead, then," she said suddenly, bringing the topic back to Mrs. Bull.
"The one that lives in the lane."
"That's her," I said.
"How did you know?"
"I saw someone like that, hanging about," Porcelain said evasively.
"Where?" I demanded.
"About," she said, locking eyes with me, just daring me to stare her down.
The truth hit me like a slap in the face.
"Your dream," I said.
"It was her. In your dream, you saw her standing over you in the caravan, didn't you?"
It made perfect sense.
If Fenella really could see into the past and the future, and her daughter, Lunita, could impress the Air Ministry with her powers, there was no reason Porcelain couldn't summon up such an unpleasant woman in her sleep.
"It was like no dream I've ever had before," Porcelain said. "Oh, but God, I wish I'd never had it."
"What do you mean?"
"It didn't seem like a dream. I'd fallen asleep on Fenella's bed, didn't even bother taking off my clothes. It must have been a noise that roused me, somewhere close, inside the caravan."
"You dreamed you'd fallen asleep?"
Porcelain nodded. "That was what was so horrible about it. I didn't move a muscle, just kept taking deep, quiet breaths, as if I was asleep, which I was, of course. Oh, damn, it's so hard to explain."
"Go on," I said.
"I know what you mean. You were in my bed, dreaming you were in Fenella's bed." She gave me a look of gratitude. "There wasn't a sound. I listened for a long time, until I thought they were gone, and then I opened my eyes, no more than a sliver, and..."
"And?"
"There was a face, a big face, right there, just inches away, almost touching mine."
"Good Lord."
"So close, I couldn't really focus," Porcelain went on. "I managed to make a little moan, as if I was dreaming, let my mouth fall open a bit. I have to admit, I was filled with admiration. I hope that, even in a dream, I should have the presence of mind to do the same thing myself." "The lamp was burning low," she went on. "It shone through the hair. I could only see the hair."
"Which was red," I said.
"Which was red.
Long and curly, wild it was, and then I opened my eyes.
Yes, yes, go on.
And it should have been your face I was looking at, shouldn't it? But it wasn't. It was that face of the man with the red hair. That's why I flew at you and nearly choked you to death.
Hold on, I said. The man with the red hair?
He was beastly, all covered with soot. He looked like someone who slept in a haystack.
I shook my head. In a weird way, it made sense, I suppose, that in a dream, Porcelain should transform Mrs. Bull, whom she had perhaps glimpsed in the gully, into a red-headed wild man.
Daffy had not long before been reading a book by Professor Jung, and had announced to us suddenly that dreams were symbols that lurked in the subconscious mind. Ordinarily, I should have written off the contents of a dream as rubbish. But my recent life seems so flooded with inexplicable instances to the contrary. In the first place, there had been Fenella's vision, in her crystal ball, of Harriet wanting me to help her come home from the cold. And even though Fenella had claimed that Feely and Daffy put her up to it, the whole thing had left me shaken, wondering, in fact, if her confession was not itself a lie. Then, too, there had been Brookie's tale about the restless grey lady of Buckshaw. I still hadn't decided if he'd been having me on about the so-called legend, but there'd been simply no time to look into it on my own. I must admit, though, that these nibblings of the supernatural at the base of my brain were more than a little unnerving.
Why didn't you tell me this before?
I don't know. Everything's so confusing. Part of me didn't trust you enough, and I knew that you no more trusted me.
I wasn't sure about your clothes, I told her. I wondered why you had to wash them in the river.
Yes, you put that in your notebook, didn't you? You thought I might have been soaked with Fenella's blood.
Well, I...
Come on, Flavia, admit it. You thought I bashed in Fenella's skull to inherit the caravan or something.
Well, it was a possibility, I said with a grin, hoping it would be infectious.
The fact of the matter is, she said, giving her hair a toss, then winding and unwinding a long strand of it round a forefinger, that women away from home sometimes feel the urge to rinse out a few things.
Oh, I said.
If you'd taken the trouble to ask me, I'd have told you. Even if it wasn't meant as such, I took this as an invitation to ask blunt questions.
All right, I said. Then let me ask you this. When the man in the caravan was leaning over you in your dream, did you notice anything besides his hair?
I thought I knew the answer, but I didn't want to put words in her mouth.
Porcelain knitted her brows and pursed her lips.
I don't think so. Wait! There was something else. It was so ghastly, I must have forgotten it when you woke me so suddenly.
I leaned forward eagerly.
Yes, I said. Already my pulse was beginning to race.
Fish, she said. There was the most awful reek of dead fish. Ugh!
I could have hugged her. I could have put my arm around her waist and... If it hadn't been for that curious stiffness in the diluted blood that keeps me on an invisible tether, danced her round the room.
Fish, I said, just as I thought.
Already my mind was a flask at the boil, the largest bubbles being Brookie Harewood and his reeking creel, Ursula Vipond and her decaying willow withies, and Miss Mountjoy with her lifetime supply of cod liver oil. The problem was this. Not a single one of them had red hair. So far, the only redheads in my investigation were the Bulls. Mrs. Bull and the two little Bulls. The little ones were out of the question. They were far too young to have attacked Fenella or murdered Brookie. Which left the obnoxious Mrs. B, who, in spite of her other failings, did not, to the best of my knowledge, smell of fish. If she did, Mrs. Mullet couldn't have resisted mentioning it. Fish or no fish, though, Mrs. Bull had an obvious grievance against Fenella, whom she believed to have kidnapped her baby. But whoever left the fishy smell hanging about the caravan was not necessarily the same person who fractured Fenella's skull with the crystal ball. And whoever had done that had not necessarily murdered Brookie.
"I'm glad I don't think as hard as you do," Porcelain said. "Your eyes go all far away and you look like someone else, someone older. It's quite frightening, actually."
"Yes," I said, even though this was news to me.
"I've tried to," she said, "but it just doesn't seem to work. I can't think who would want to harm Fenella, and that man, the one we found hanging from the fountain, whoever would want to kill him?" That was the question. Porcelain had put her finger on it.
The whole thing came down to what Inspector Hewitt would call motive. Brookie was an embarrassment to his mother and had stolen from Miss Mountjoy. As far as I knew, he had no connection with the Pettibones, other than the fact that he provided them with stolen goods. It would be odd indeed if those two old curios had murdered him. Without her husband's help, Mrs. Pettibone could never have manhandled Brookie's body into the position in which Porcelain and I had found it. Even with her husband's help, old Pettibone was so frail they'd have needed a motorized crane. Or the assistance of their friend Edward Sampson, who owned acres of rusting machinery in East Finching.
"I can think of only one person," I said.
"And who might that be?"
"I'm afraid I can't tell you."
"So much for trust," she said in a flat voice.
"So much for trust." It hurt me to cut her off in that way, but I had my reasons, one of which was that she might be forced to spill the beans to Inspector Hewitt. I couldn't have anyone interfering when I was so close to a solution. Another was that Brookie's killer and Fenella's attacker were still at large, and I couldn't possibly put Porcelain at risk. She was safe enough here at Buckshaw, but how long could I keep her presence a secret? That's what I was thinking about when there came a light tap on the door.
"Yes," I called out.
A moment later, Father walked into the room.
"Flavia," he began, then stopped in his tracks. Porcelain leapt from the bed and back towards a corner of the room. Father stared at her for a moment, and then at me, then back at Porcelain again.
"Excuse me," he said, "I didn't realize."
"Father," I said, "I should like to introduce Porcelain Lee."
"How do you do?" Father said, after an almost imperceptible pause, then sticking out his hand at once, rather than waiting for her to do so first.
He was obviously flustered. Porcelain came forward a couple of halting steps and gave him a single shake, up, down.
"Lovely weather we've been having," Father went on. "When it isn't raining, of course."
I saw my opportunity and I took it.
"It was Porcelain's grandmother, Mrs. Farr, who was attacked in the gully," I said.
What seemed like an eternity of shadows fled across Father's face.
"I was saddened to hear of that," he said at last, "but I'm given to believe she's going to make a splendid recovery."
Neither of them knowing what to say next, they stood there staring fixedly at each other, and then Father said,
"You'll join us for supper, of course."
"You could have knocked me down with a moth-eaten feather."
Dear old Father, how I admired him. Generations of breeding and his natural gallantry had turned what might have been a sticky situation into a perfect triumph, and my bedroom, rather than the anticipated field of battle, had suddenly become a reception chamber. Porcelain lowered her eyelids to signal assent.
"Good," Father exclaimed. "That's settled, then."
He turned to me.
"Mrs. Mullet returned not 10 minutes ago to retrieve her purse. Left it in the pantry. If she's still here, I'll ask her if she wouldn't mind. I believe she might still be in the kitchen."
And with that, he was gone.
"Crikey," Porcelain said.
"Quick," I told her.
There's not a minute to lose. You'll probably want to have a wash-up and change into something more fresh. She'd been wearing Fenella's dowdy black outfit for days and looked, to be perfectly frank, like a Covent Garden flower seller.
My things won't fit you, I said, but Daffy's or Feely's will.
I beckoned her to follow, then led her through the creaking upstairs corridors. That's Daffy's room, I said, pointing, when we reached the west wing of the house. And that's Feely's. Help yourself. I'm sure they won't mind. See you at supper. Come down when the gong is struck.
I don't know what makes me do these things, but secretly I could hardly wait to see how my sisters reacted when Porcelain came down for supper in one of their favourite frocks. I hadn't really had the chance to pay them back properly for the humiliation in the cellars. My jiggered looking glass had backfired horribly, but now, suddenly, out of the blue, dear old fate had given me a second chance.
Not only that, but Mrs. M had turned up unexpectedly in the kitchen, which presented a perfect opportunity to ask her the question that might well stamp this case closed. I flew down the stairs and skipped into the kitchen. Hallelujah! Mrs. Mullet was alone.
Sorry to hear you forgot your purse, I said. If I'd known sooner, I could have brought it to you. It would have been no trouble at all.
This was called storing up credits, and it operated on the same principle as indulgences in the Roman Catholic Church, or what the shops in London called the layaway plan.
Thank you, dear, Mrs. M said. But it's just as well I come back. The Colonel's asked me to set a few things on the table, and I don't mind, really, seeing as it's Alf's lodge night, and I wouldn't have much to do anyway but knit and train the budgerigar. We're teaching it to say, "Ee, it was agony, Ivy." You should hear it, dear. Alf says it's ever so humorous.
As she spoke, she bustled about the kitchen, preparing to serve supper. I took a deep breath and made the leap.
"Was Brookie Harewood a hobbler?" I asked.
"Brookie? I'm sure I couldn't tell you, dear. All I knows is, last time I seen him slinking round the church, I told the vicar, 'You'd best lock up the communion plate.' That's what I said. 'You'd best lock up the communion plate before it goes pop like a weasel.'
What about Edward Sampson? Do you know anything about him?"
"Ted Sampson? I should say I do. Reggie's half-brother, he is. A regular bad bun, that one. Owns that salvage yard in East Finchin. And Alf says there's more an old tin goes through them gates. I shouldn't be telling you this, dear. Tender ears and all that."
I was filling in the blanks nicely. Pettibone and Company, under cover of a quiet shop, an out-of-the-way salvage yard, and an eccentric religion, were operating an antique theft and forgery ring. Although I had suspected this for some time, I had not seen, until now, how all of it fitted together. Essentially, Brookie stole, Edward copied, and Reginald sold treasures removed from stately homes. The ingenious twist was this. After the original objects were copied, they were returned to their owners so that they would seldom, if ever, be missed. Or were the originals replaced with the copies? I had not yet had time to find that out, but when I did, I would begin by making a chemical analysis of Sally Fox and Shoppo's metallic content. I had originally intended to begin with the Deluce lobster pick I had found in the hands of Timothy. Or was it really Timothy Ball? But the demands on my time had made that impossible. With his gob full of sweets, Timothy had been very difficult to understand. I smiled as I recalled the child mucking in the lane. "Danny's pocket," he had replied when I had asked him where he got his pretty digger. In retrospect, he was almost cute. "And Mrs. Ball, of course. Is she a hobbler too?"
"I couldn't say," Mrs. Mallet said. "I've been told Tilda Mountjoy was one of them, but I never heard of it said that Margaret Ball was, even though them two is as thick as thieves.
Them hobblers go traipsing round to one another's houses of a Sunday to sing their hymns and shout and roll about on the floor as if they was trying to smother a fire in their unmentionables and God knows what all else. I tried to picture Miss Mountjoy rolling around on the floor in the grips of religious ecstasy, but my imagination, vivid as it is, was not up to it.
"They're a rum lot," Mrs. M. went on. "But there's not a one of them would let Margaret Bull through their front gate, not in a month of Sundays, not any more."
"Why not?"
"Something happened when that baby of hers got took. She was never the same after, not that she was much of a marvel before."
"What about her husband, Tom Bull?"
"He took it real hard, nearly killed him, they say. He went off not long after. And my friend Mrs. Waller said his wife told her, in confidence, mind, that he wouldn't be coming back."
"Maybe he went off to find work.
Dogger says a lot of men have done that since the end of the war." "He had work enough, work for Pettibone's brother-in-law."
"Ted Sampson?"
"The very one we was talking about. A foundryman Tom Bull was, and a good one, so they say, even though he had his troubles with the police. But when that baby girl of his got took, something happened, inside-like, and he went off his head. Not long after it were, he was up and gone."
How I longed to blurt out to her that the body of Tom Bull's baby daughter had been found in the parlings, but I dared not breathe a word. The news had not yet reached the village, and I didn't want to be accused of leaking information that the police would sooner keep to themselves. At least for the time being. "You better run along and clean up for dinner, dear," Mrs. Mallet said suddenly, breaking in upon my train of thought. "The Colonel says you're having company to supper, so we won't want to see dirty hands at the table." I held my tongue. In ordinary circumstances, I should have lashed out against such an impertinent remark. But today, I had a new weapon.
"Quite right, Mrs. M.," I heard myself saying, as I trotted instantly and obediently to the door. Here I paused, turned dramatically, and then in my best, innocent as a lamb voice, said,
"Oh, by the way, Mrs. Mallet, Vanetta Harewood showed me her portrait of Harriet." The clatter of dishes stopped, and for a few moments there was a stony silence in the kitchen.
"I knew this day would come," Mrs. Mallet said suddenly in an odd voice, the voice of a stranger. "I've been half expecting it."
She collapsed suddenly into a chair at the table, buried her face in her apron, and dissolved into a miserable sobbing. I stood by helplessly, not quite knowing what to do. At last, I pulled out the chair opposite, sat down at the table, and watched her weep. I had a special fascination with tears. Chemical analyses of my own and those of others had taught me that tears were a rich and wonderful broth, whose chief ingredients were water, potassium, proteins, manganese, various yeasty enzymes, fats, oils and waxes, with a good dollop of sodium chloride thrown in, perhaps for taste. In sufficient quantities, they made for a powerful cleanser. Not so very different, I thought, from Mrs. Mallet's chicken soup, which she flung at even the slightest sniffle. By now, Mrs. M. had begun to subside, and she said, without removing the apron from her face, "A gift it was. She wanted it for the Colonel." I reached out across the table and placed my hand on her shoulder. I didn't say a word. Slowly, the apron came down, revealing her anguished face. She took a shuddering breath. "She wanted to surprise him with it. Oh, the trouble she went to. She was ever so happy, bundling up you lot of angels and motoring over to Malden Fenwick for your sittings, having that Harewood woman come here to Buckshaw whenever the Colonel was away. Bitter cold it was. Bitter." She mopped at her eyes, and I suddenly felt ill. Why had I ever mentioned the painting? Had I done it for no reason other than to shock Mrs. Mallet, to see her response?
I hoped not.
Oh, I've wanted to tell the Colonel about it, Mrs. Mullet went on quietly.
But I couldn't. It's not my place.
To think of it lying there in her studio all these years and him not knowing it. It breaks my heart. It surely does. It breaks my heart.
It breaks mine too, Mrs. M, I said. And it was the truth.
As she pulled herself to her feet, her face still wet and red, something stirred in my memory.
Red.
Red hair. Timothy Ball, his mouth stuffed with sweets and the silver lobster pick in his hand.
Danny's pocket, he'd said, when I asked him where he got it. Danny's pocket.
And I had misheard him.
Daddy's pocket.
Red and silver. This was what my dreams and my good sense had been trying to tell me. I felt suddenly as if a snail were slowly crawling up my spine.
Could it be that Tom Bull was still in Bishop's Lacey? Could he still be living secretly amid the smoke that blanketed his house in the gully? If so, it might well be he who'd been outside smoking as I crept with Gry past his house in the dark. Perhaps it was he who had watched from the wood as Inspector Hewitt and his men removed Brookie's body from the Poseidon fountain. He who had removed the pick from Brookie's nose when Porcelain and I...
Good Lord! And Timothy had found the lobster pick in his father's pocket, which could only mean... At that very instant, the gong in the foyer was rung, announcing supper.
Better get along, dear, Mrs. Mullet said, poking at her hair with a forefinger and giving her face a last swipe with her apron. You know what your father's like about promptness. We mustn't keep him waiting.
Yes, Mrs. Mullet, I said. Chapter 28. The household had been summoned, and we all of us stood waiting in the foyer. I understood at once that Father had decided to make an occasion of Porcelain's presence in the house. Perhaps, I thought, because he felt remorse for the way in which he had treated her grandparents. He still did not know, of course, about the tragic death of Johnny Farr. I stood at the bottom of the stairs, a little apart from the others, taking in, as if for the first time, the sad splendour of the Deleuze ancestral home. There had been a time when Buckshaw rang with laughter, or so I'd been told, but quite frankly, I could not even imagine it. The house seemed to hold itself in stiff disapproval, reflecting only the sound of whispers, setting dim but rigid limits on the lives of all of us who had lived within its walls. Other than Father's Gorgon sister, Aunt Felicity, who made annual expeditions in order to berate him, there had been no guests at Buckshaw for as long as I could remember. Daffy and Feely stood with annoyingly perfect posture on either side of Father, both of them scrubbed to disgusting perfection, like the well-bred but rather dim daughters of the local squire in a drawing-room drama. Just wait till they saw Porcelain. To one side, Dogger hovered, nearly invisible against the dark panelling, save for his white face and his white hair, like a disembodied head afloat in the gloom. Glancing at his military wristwatch, Father made a slight involuntary frown, but covered it nicely by pulling out his handkerchief and giving his nose an unconvincing blow. He was nervous. We stood there in silence, each of us staring off in a different direction. Precisely 15 minutes after the gong had sounded, a door closed somewhere above, and we focused our attention upon the top of the staircase. As Porcelain appeared, we gasped collectively, and Mrs. Mullet, who had just come from the kitchen, gave out a cry like a small nocturnal animal. I thought for a moment she was going to bolt. Porcelain had not chosen from Daffy's or Feely's wardrobe. She was dressed in one of my mother's most memorable outfits, the knee-length flame-coloured dress of orange silk chiffon that Harriet had worn to the Royal Aero Society Ball the year before her final journey. A photograph had been taken by the Times that evening as Harriet arrived at the Savoy. A photograph that created a stir that to this day has never been quite forgotten. But it wasn't just the dress. Porcelain had pulled her hair back in the same way that Harriet had done when she was riding to the hounds. She must have copied the style from the black and white photo on Harriet's desk. Because I had rifled my mother's jewel box myself from time to time, I recognized at once the antique amber necklace that lay against Porcelain's surprisingly well-developed bosom and the stones that glittered on her fingers. Harriet's. All of them Harriet's. Porcelain paused on the top step and looked down at us with what I took at the time to be shyness, but later decided might well have been contempt. I must say that Father behaved magnificently, although at first I was sure he was going to faint. As Porcelain began her long, slow descent, his jaw muscles began tightening and loosening reflexively. As with most military men, it was the only permissible show of emotion, and as such, it was at once both nerve-wracking and deeply endearing. Down and down she came towards us, floating on the air like some immortal sprite. Pixie, perhaps, I thought wildly. Perhaps Queen Mab herself. As she neared the bottom, Porcelain broke into the most heartbreaking smile that I have ever seen on a human face. A smile that encompassed us all and yet, at the same time, managed to single out each one of us for particular dazzlement. No queen, not even Cleopatra herself, had ever made such an entrance, and I found myself gaping in open-mouthed admiration at the sheer audacity of it. As she swept lightly past me at the bottom of the stairs, she leaned in close upon my neck, her lips almost brushing my ear. "How do I look?" she whispered. All she needed was a rose in her teeth, but I hardly dared say so. Father took a single step forward and offered her his arm.
"Shall we go in to dinner?" he asked.
"Macaroons," Porcelain said. "How I love them." Mrs. Mullet beamed.
"I shall give you the recipe, dear," she said.
"It's the tin milk as gives them the extra fillet." I nearly gagged, but a few deft passes of my table napkin provided a neat distraction. Daffy and Feely, to give them credit, had, apart from their initial goggling, seemed not to have turned a hair at Porcelain's borrowed costume, although they couldn't take their eyes off her. At the table, they asked interesting questions, mostly about her life in London during the war. In general, and against all odds, my sisters were charming beyond belief. And Father, dear Father, although Porcelain's sudden appearance in Harriet's wardrobe must have shocked him deeply, he managed somehow to keep a miraculously tight grip on himself. In fact, for a few hours, it was as if Harriet had been returned to him from the dead. He smiled. He listened attentively. And at one point, he even told rather an amusing story about an old lady's first encounter with a beekeeper. It was as if, for a few hours, Porcelain had cast a spell upon us all. There was only one awkward moment, and it came towards the end of the evening. Feely had just finished playing a lovely piano arrangement of Antonin Dvorak's Gypsy Songs, Opus 55, songs my great-grandfather taught me, one of her great favourites. "Well," she asked, getting up from the piano and turning to Porcelain, "what do you think? I've always wanted to hear the opinion of a real gypsy." "You could have cut the silence with a knife."
"Ophelia," Father said.
I held my breath, afraid that Porcelain would be offended, but I needn't have worried. "Quite beautiful in places," she said, giving Feely that dazzling smile. "Of course, I'm no more than half gypsy, so I only enjoyed every other section."
I thought she was going to leap over the piano stool and scratch my eyes out.
We were back upstairs in my bedroom after what had been, for both of us, something of an ordeal. "Feely wouldn't do that," I said, "at least not with Father in the room. There had been no mention of Brookie Harewood, and apart from a politer inquiry by Father,
"I hope your grandmother is getting on well,"
nothing whatever said about Fenella. It was just as well, as I didn't fancy having to answer inconvenient and perhaps even embarrassing questions about my recent activities.
"They seem nice, though, your sisters, really," Porcelain remarked.
"Ha!" I said. "Shows what little you know. I hate them."
"Hate them? I should have thought you'd love them."
"Of course I love them," I said, throwing myself full length onto the bed. "That's why I'm so good at hating them."
"I think you're having me on. What have they ever done to you?"
"They torture me," I said. "But please, don't ask me for details." When I knew that I had gained her undivided attention, I rolled over onto my stomach so that I couldn't see her. Talking to someone dressed in my mother's clothing was eerie enough, without recounting to her the tortures my sisters had inflicted upon me.
"Torture you?" she said. "In what way? Tell me about it."
For a long while, there was only the sound of my brass alarm clock ticking on the bedside table, chopping the long minutes into manageable segments. Then, in a rush, it all came spilling out. I found myself telling her about my ordeal in the cellars, how they had lugged me down the stairs, dumped me on the stone floor, and frightened me with horrid voices, how they had told me I was a changeling, left behind by the pixies when the real Flavia Deluce was abducted. Until I heard myself telling it to Porcelain, I had no idea how badly shaken the ordeal had left me.
"Do you believe me?" I asked, desperate somehow for a yes.
"I'd like to," she said. "But it's hard to imagine such ladylike young women operating their own private dungeon."
"Ladylike young women?"
I'm afraid I almost uttered a word that would have shocked a sailor. "Come on," I said, leaping to my feet and tugging at her arm. "I'll show you what ladylike young women get up to when no one is looking."
"Cool," Porcelain said. "It's a bloody crypt."
In spite of an occasional electric bulb strung here and there on frayed wiring, the cellars were a sea of darkness. I had brought from the pantry the pewter candlestick that was kept for those not infrequent occasions when the current failed at Buckshaw, and I held it above my head, moving the flickering light from side to side.
"See, there's the sack they threw over my head."
"And look," I said, holding the candle down close to the flagstones. "Here are their footprints in the dust."
"Seems like rather a lot of them for a couple of ladylike young women," Porcelain said skeptically. "Rather large, too," she added. She was right. I could see that at once.
Distinct footprints led off into the darkness, too big to be Daffy's, or mine, or Feely's, which mingled near the bottom of the stairs. Nor were they Father's. He had not come all the way down the steps, and even if he had, his leather-soled shoes left distinct impressions with which I was quite familiar. Dogger's footprints, too, were unmistakable, long and narrow, and placed one in front of the other with the precision of a Red Indian. No, these were not Father's footprints, nor were they Dogger's. If my suspicions were correct, they had been made by someone wearing rubber boots.